Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Disgraced former FEMA director Michael Brown has become the poster child for a boiling charge against the Bush administration, cronyism. The wrong people hired for the wrong reasons. In testimony before Congress yesterday, Brown was defiant and unrepentant.
You see, I get it when it comes to incident command systems. I get it when it comes to emergency management. I know what it's all about.
All presidents practice patronage, but now comes the charge that this administration has put more unqualified friends into more high places than ever before, that some appointees have been dispatched precisely to undermine the very agency they were appointed to serve, that in the case of Katrina and maybe elsewhere, a dangerous incompetence is the result. It's a political charge, but this is politics and government. This hour On Point, the charge of cronyism gone wild in the Bush administration. You can join the conversation. Is the country getting the CEO MBA management that was advertised when George W. Bush was elected? Is this business as usual in Washington or something different? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Thompson, national correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote a story this week headlined, How Many More Mike Browns Are Out There? Mark Thompson, thanks for being with us.
Sure, Tom.
So tell us what's new here. You all describe that this is got a long history. JFK put his brother in charge of the Justice Department. Bill Clinton gave his most ambitious domestic policy initiative in health care over to his wife. George H.W. Bush, as you reported, put so many friends in the Commerce Department that the agency was known internally as Bush Gardens. Is there something new going on here?
Yeah, I think it's important for people to realize that the last several presidents all have had some 3,000 slots that they've been able to fill. And the filling of those slots isn't to be thought of like a light switch. Either they're all cronies or they're all not, mm-hmm. because that's not the way it works. Mm-hmm. What we have in this administration, I think, is fairly to be described as a rheostat or a thermostat, slowly creeping upwards, seeping upwards with more political people in these kind of slots, especially those just below the radar screens, than we have ever seen before.
So you've got a difference in what? In the intensity of their commitment to the president, to a political ideal? Is it quality, quantity? What do you mean by a rheostat?
Well, some of it obviously is just political cronies who may be incompetent or may not be incompetent, but don't really have a big impact on policy. We've got an ambassador to France who doesn't speak French, for example. I mean, how big of a crime is that? But when you look at positions like the IGs, the sort of the goalkeeper of federal government, the last—
The IGs, the inspector
the
generals.
The inspector generals who, are confirmed by the Senate to root out fraud, waste, and corruption. And you just look at the difference in the IGs, there's 57 of them, in this administration compared to the Clinton administration,
okay.
And it's quite remarkable. I mean, in the Bush administration, some 64% of the IGs now serving have some sort of political connection. That level in the Clinton administration was 22%. Well, what about auditing experience? In the current administration, only 18% of the IGs have any sort of audit experience. In the Clinton administration, that number was 66%. So that's one narrow slice of the federal bureaucracy that you can look at and really get hard numbers in just what ways the workforce has changed under this president.
And these, the inspector generals, are supposed to be the sort of bottom-line watchdogs of the federal government. You write that Bush has gone further than most presidents to put political stalwarts in some of the most important government jobs you've never heard of and to give them genuine power. Give us some chapter and verse here, Mark Thompson. What are we talking about? Everybody knows the story of Brownie now, of Mark Brown.
But beyond
Mike Brown. Yes. Okay.
That's all right, Tim.
Okay. But take us beyond FEMA. And what do you see out there?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, of course, just glancing off of FEMA, is the fact that you never hear of the FEMA director until there's a disaster. And then all of a sudden, gee, is this guy any good? And you knew within a couple of days that he was in trouble, because whenever people start investigating resumes, that's always a bad sign for the job holder. older. And, you know, in the wake of Katrina, a lot of reporters have been looking at a lot of resumes. And in fact, at time, we were looking at David Safavian before his recent unpleasantness. David Safavian runs or ran the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. That's a true WONC title. It's someone who oversees the more than $300 billion a year that the federal government spends.
That's power.
That's power. Everything from paperclips to nuclear submarines, as well as services like mowing lawns and contracting out computer work. And this fellow really, in that position, had very little procurement experience. While he was an intern in law school, he worked helping the Pentagon buy helicopters. But that was the extent of his hands-on experience.
So how did he get the job?
These trails are always difficult to trace, but he was a partner with Grover Norquist, who runs Americans for Tax Reform, a key Bush ally on cutting federal taxes. He also worked alongside Jack Abramoff, the famed and now disgraced GOP fundraiser and attorney and lobbyist, who is now under indictment. In fact, Mr. Safavian took a golfing trip with Mr. Abramoff to Scotland in 2002. When this was reported to a hotline, a government hotline, the director of OFPP, David Safavian, said, "Listen, I paid for that trip," and indeed he did. But what he didn't, what the government alleges he didn't disclose, was the fact that he and Abramoff had many conversations on the QT using private email accounts, and that Safavian was trying to get Abramoff access and control of two key pieces of federal property in Washington. And that's why he resigned 2 weeks ago and was arrested.
And has been arrested, charged with lying and obstructing a criminal investigation. So there's the David Safavian story. Take us on through the closet here. What else did you find, Mark?
Well, Julie Myers is, by all accounts, a smart, savvy young attorney. She also happens to be the niece of the outgoing chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. She also happens to have recently wed the chief of staff to Mike Chertoff, the head of the Department of Homeland Security. She has been recommended, and her nomination is now pending before the U.S. Senate to run the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, a mammoth agency that, in the wake of 9/11, is really important. And, in fact, the Congress demanded that whoever holds this job have 5 years of experience in related fields.
She's 36 years old, not much time to get 5 years of experience.
Right, especially after law school and all of that. And only by counting some pretty rinky-dink White House assignments can you contend she had 5 years of experience. And I'm sorry, there's no way on God's green earth that this is the best qualified Republican for this job at this time.
Essentially, to be in charge of all American immigration and customs, when she came before the Senate committee looking at this, Ohio Republican George Voinovich said to her, "I'd really like to have Mike Chertoff, her would-be boss, spend some time telling us personally why he thinks you're qualified for the job based on the resume. I don't think you are a Republican senator." Pretty tough on this appointee or nominee.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what's very interesting. I don't know if folks paid attention yesterday when former FEMA Director Mike Brown testified on Capitol Hill, but some of the toughest comments regarding his tenure came from Christopher Shays and other Republicans who are pretty upset that, you know, hey, we, the Republicans, took over Capitol Hill in a big way in 1994. Now we've got all both the Senate and the House, as well as the White House. This sort of stuff should not be happening on our watch, and they were quite distressed.
You also describe a 33-year-old doctor turned stock picker who is now very high in the FDA, looking at safety decisions about drugs. Scott Gottlieb, what's the issue?
Yeah, he is a 33-year-old doctor turned stock picker who basically was hired at the second highest level in FDA to provide policy guidance. That's generally what folks at that level do. But in recent weeks, twice, according to emails obtained by Time, after scientists made decisions based on scientific reasoning and their professed good judgment that we should market this pill or we shouldn't market that pill or we should take this one off the market or we shouldn't continue experiments with this particular drug, He sent what many scientists in the FDA, because these things spread like wildfire, deemed to be basically chilling and intimidating messages that said, isn't this an overreaction that we want to do this, or why are we doing that? And frankly, these folks at the FDA, who are the scientists, who are the government's guardians of the public health, were quite distraught that a political appointee would be weighing in on the scientific merits. They just felt that was completely out of bounds.
And so the list goes on. But still, we have to ask, Mark Thompson, could one not have reached into any presidential administration in the last, I don't know, century and come up with a comparable list? Is there something that is really different in a substantive way about this? I mean, these are bad, but couldn't these stones be thrown at almost any White House?
Yeah, I think the stones could, Tom. The issue isn't the stones. The issue is the fields of stones, and that's why I mentioned the IG numbers, which are pretty compelling sense that, hey, something has changed here. I mean, listen, in concert with the GOP takeover of the Hill, when the Bush administration came to power, they made very clear that they felt the federal government was a bit bloated and things could be done better, be done more efficiently, could be done more leanly. And one of the ways they were going to do it was by remaking the top levels of making the political appointees have greater power. And I talked to several political scientists who say, well, yes, every administration does this. The self-correcting mechanism on it we have is called elections. If you don't like it, next time you can vote in a new team. But they also noted that the discipline here and their desire to wend themselves in, not just to supervise from the White House, but to actually put people in charge of faith-based initiatives into each agency is a whole different thing that we haven't seen before and is more pervasive than has been commonplace in the past.
Mark Thompson, with time, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking this hour about the charge of cronyism and incompetence in the Bush administration and whether it's the same as it's ever been under many administrations or something different here. You can join the conversation. Have you heard the Michael Brown testimony? Have you read the litany of political appointees? Has something gone wrong here, or is this same old, same old? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the charge of cronyism and incompetence in the Bush administration. You can join the conversation. Presidents always bring in their own crew. Is this different? And what happened to the CEO presidency, the MBA administration? Republican listeners, what do you make of this? Did you expect better? Or is it not as bad as it looks? Has a Republican revolution turned into a patronage party? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been hearing from Mark Thompson, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, co-author of the big story this week headlined How Many More Mike Browns Are Out There? We're joined right now from Washington by Congressman Henry Waxman, Democratic member of Congress from California's 30th District. He, along with House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, has introduced anti-cronyism legislation. Congressman Waxman, thanks for being with us. What are you up to here?
I'm pleased to be with you. It just seems to me that when you have appointees in charge of public safety, they ought to be required to be based on some background. They ought to have some background in that field, and our legislation would spell that out. We don't require elimination of patronage, but if they're going to try to pay off their old supporters with jobs at our taxpayers' expense, they ought to have at least a good sense to appoint them where they can't do any harm.
You call it
an appointment of Michael Brown is an example of an appointment that meant the difference between life and death.
You call it the Anti-Cronyism and Public Safety Act, and all of this is keying off what happened in Katrina. It sort of brought everything else tumbling out. But is this really different, Congressman, than what's gone on in previous administrations, Republican and Democrat?
In previous administrations, there have been political friends appointed to top jobs. Maybe that's never going to change. But when it comes to a job involving public safety, whether it's in the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Health and Human Services, if people's lives are involved, if public health and safety is involved, then we ought to require that any appointee, and it could be narrowed down to appointees that are Republicans or Democrats, depending on the administration, if that's what they want to do, any minimal competence. He was a crony of a crony, and that's how he got his job.
You're a Democrat and a critic, but what's your theory of the case? If things have gone wrong in this direction, if they went wrong at FEMA, why? What's moving behind all this?
Lack of competence, dysfunctionality. It isn't that FEMA has always been a bad agency. It was quite a successful agency during the Clinton administration. I know because of the earthquake we had in California, FEMA responded magnificently and very professionally. But we've been looking at the horrors of this Katrina hurricane and the impact it had. Notwithstanding, there had been recommendations a year before to FEMA about a possible hurricane that could take 10,000 lives. It could be exactly what happened. Luckily, we didn't have that many lives lost. There were no contingency contracts ready to even remove dead bodies. Nothing was in place, and everything had to be rushed in place on a mad dash basis in order to give out contracts. They've been giving out contracts since Katrina by just telephone conversations, nothing written down, a lot of them without any competition.
Michael Brown himself said yesterday in his testimony, one of my frustrations over the past 3 years has been the emaciation of FEMA, a brain drain there. He said he was struggling just to keep the place together. But why would this be done? I mean, what's the... You say the problem is incompetence, but George Bush presumably has no interest in having incompetent managers of the government, so why would it happen?
You would think that he would have no interest in it, anybody incompetent, and certainly I'm sure he regrets it now. But Brown was appointed because he was a roommate of Joe Alba, who was his predecessor at FEMA. Joe Alba was appointed head of FEMA because he ran Bush's campaign. He didn't have any background either in this area. In fact, Alba moved out to become a lobbyist who's now arranging contracts with companies that have close ties to the Republicans and making sure that there's no bidding competition for these contracts, and he gets a fee out of the taxpayers' money to pay for the contracts. But Brown had no qualifications at all and didn't do anything in advance, even though FEMA was warned that there could be a hurricane of this magnitude. And now we're seeing contracts of some of the same old cronies that Alba was recommending. It's a waste of taxpayers' money. It's dysfunctionality. I don't know if they didn't have enough money, but we never heard that they didn't have enough money. Maybe it was an error, probably was, to put FEMA in the Department of Homeland Security, but that's what the administration wanted, even though some of us argued against it at the time.
Of course, there were Democrats arguing for it, too. Congressman, is this going to be seen, ultimately, your bill as pure politics? Does it have a snowball's chance? We heard Republicans being pretty tough at points on Brown yesterday. Are they upset, Republicans upset enough that they might come on board?
I hope so. I think a number of Republicans have been embarrassed and upset. Just as Democrats are looking with horror at the way that government at all levels, not just the federal government, local government as well, was not able to deal with the hurricane and responding to it and preventing some of the harm that has happened.
Henry Waxman, Congressman from California, Democrat, co-sponsor with Nancy Pelosi of a new bill, cronyism and public safety. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Henry Waxman joining us there from Washington. We've been joined from Washington as well by Mark Thompson of Time Magazine, and we're joined from New York right now by Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He led the Presidential Appointee Initiative there. He studied in depth the question of political appointees in this and past administrations. Paul Light, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
We're trying to get a handle on whether this is same as it's ever been or something different, something new, something worse. What's your take?
It is not quantitatively worse, I don't think. I mean, we've had about 3,000 political appointees now for 15 to 20 years. I think it is qualitatively different in the sense that the pool of eligible nominees in this Bush administration has been narrowed by a very intense concern about loyalty and ideological sympathy. So that when the Bush people, Bush 43 here, has been looking for people to populate these key positions, he's had fewer and fewer people to pick from. Julie Myers, we don't know how she got the nomination, but she may have been the first choice of the administration. The emphasis in picking people for these jobs has been loyalty, loyalty, and loyalty. And the White House has been very strong-armed to exact that loyalty and to translate that loyalty into policy allegiance out in the departments. They don't like dissent particularly. We saw a couple of very talented public servants in Paul O'Neill and Colin Powell leave their jobs because they had dissented publicly. So I think the Bush people have painted themselves into a corner with this ideological intensity. The pool is much, much shallower for the choice of nominees for these key jobs, and some of them just aren't qualified. One of the reasons, incidentally, that FEMA has been emaciated, and one of the reasons for the brain drain, is Mike Brown.
Because why?
Senior careerists look up the ladder and they say, you know, back to the future. This is what it used to be like before the 1990s. This is this, you know, this agency was a dumping ground for many, many years. We don't want to go back to that. Half of the senior executives at FEMA are eligible for retirement. Why put up with this any longer? They don't have the resources to do their jobs. They don't respect their leadership. And a lot of them have been leaving in droves, and that is in part because of the leadership problems at the agency.
Paul Light, Mark Thompson, stand by. I want to get a reply, an alternate view here. Joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, is David Johnson. He's CEO of Strategic Vision. It's a Republican public relations and public affairs agency. He's a Republican strategist, has worked on Bob Dole's presidential campaign, worked for Florida Governor Jeb Bush's 94 campaign. David Johnson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So you hear the charge. Everybody's unhappy, it seems, about Mike Brown. But the bigger charge is that the Bush administration has put ideology over competence, experience, and it is now hurting the government, hurting the country. What do you say to that?
It's not really hurting the country. We have very competent officials in there. The ones that are being brought to light are really a minority. And quite honestly, the president is taking a page out of a Democratic icon, Franklin Roosevelt, who, in his administration, over 83% of his appointees were political appointees, and there was a lot of charges of cronyism, and in fact, he actually had a political appointee that was far worse than Michael Brown in Joe Kennedy, who was ambassador to Great Britain right before World War II, and as we later found out, was pro-appeasement and pro-Nazi. So no, this isn't anything new. What the Bush administration is trying to do is really affect the realignment that we have seen occur nationwide in the elections that needs to be reflected in the bureaucracy.
And they're bringing in people with a strong ideological bent because that's what it takes to push through that Republican revolution, if you will?
In the bureaucracy, very much like Franklin Roosevelt did in the 1930s and 1940s when he began appointing Democratic bureaucrats to carry along his programs after years of Republican control in the bureaucracy.
But you say it hasn't hurt the country, but we all looked down to the Gulf just a couple of weeks ago, and it looked pretty darn painful. It looked like it was hurting badly at FEMA, which leads people to think, what are the Swiss cheese holes in other agencies led this way?
There were definitely mistakes made in FEMA, but there were mistakes made all around. There were mistakes made in the local leadership with the mayor, in the state leadership as well. If you look at Hurricane Rita, where you had a Democratic mayor of Houston and a Republican governor of Texas, we did not see the same mistakes at the state or local level that we saw in Louisiana. So there's plenty of blame to go along. I'm not saying that Michael Brown is innocent of anything, but what I'm saying is this is something that goes on in politics completely. The country is not hurt because of the president appointing strong supporters into his administration.
Mark Thompson and Paul Light, I want to get your responses here. First to you, if I may, Mark. I mean, David Johnson says, look, the president came in with an agenda. You know, there's a certain entropy in a big bureaucracy like the federal government. If you want to push through a new way of doing things, you've got to put your people in charge. Ideology matters, and why apologize for it?
Well, it's not a zero-sum game. I think we proceed down a false path when we say they've either got to be strong supporters of the president or competent. You know, they can be both simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's happening. I mean, it was obvious in the days after Katrina, as reporters began looking at Mike Brown and checking his clips, it was, how did this guy ever get into this job? And he frankly wasn't that strong a supporter of the president, if that's to be the test. I mean, he ran as a sacrificial lamb for a congressional race. But, I mean, getting back to the whole notion of why would Bush allow FEMA to wither? I mean, Joe Albaugh, in one of his first appearances on the Hill, said, people tend to view federal disaster assistance as an entitlement program, a too-fat entitlement program, and maybe we should count on more faith-based groups to help out. These comments were made 4 months before 9/11, so plainly the administration was seeking to shrink the federal government's responsibility in this area.
Paul Light, David Johnson reaches all the way back to FDR, another president who wanted to change the tenor and the ideology of government and says, look, he brought in his own people to make that happen. Why shouldn't George W. Bush do the same? What do you make of that analogy?
Well, first of all, there are many more appointees today than there were under FDR, and the pool of potential appointees is much smaller. 60% of the Bush and Clinton appointees came from inside the Beltway. There isn't the Jeffersonian ideal of the amateur citizen coming to Washington for a few years to give leadership. But, you know, to look backwards and say, hey, everybody's been doing this is not the right way to go. We want to look forward and say, what's the right way to run a government? Do we have too many political appointees? Do we have good standards for selecting them? We all had hopes, those of us who study the appointments process, at the beginning of the Bush administration, that the administration might consider the possibility of slimming down the federal hierarchy from the top on down. It's not a question of political versus career. It's a question of the number of layers between top and bottom. And time again, we've seen that information gets lost and that we just have too many layers. But that hasn't been the case. Ideology has been the ruling force here. And the fact that Clinton did it and Father Bush did it and Reagan did it doesn't excuse it. We need to make competence equally important as loyalty in the selection process.
Well, let me begin to bring our callers into this conversation, if I may. Kenny is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Kenny, you're on the air.
How y'all doing?
We're good. What do you think, Kenny?
Good. Well, I think that I better be real careful. There's a lot of intelligent information passing around here. It's like sparks. But, you know, I'd like to say that cronyism, first of all, is that a word? I mean, we make up words, and I know what it means and everything, but can we have a charge of cronyism?
Yeah, well, it's on the table right now. Do you think George Bush has done too much of it or not?
I don't think he's done any of it, and not because I'm a Republican or a supporter of George Bush. I think I'd like to make a strong statement that I think George Bush is incompetent, but I'd like to explain. Have an opportunity to explain myself. And we as Americans, we tend to look at and brush the surface and try to dig deep, but then we fall just short of what happens. I think he honestly is a good American, and he tried real hard to fill these positions to the level of his competence. And I don't mean that he's stupid. I just mean he's a simple person, and we elected him. And really, if we stop and face ourselves in the mirror, I think we're just sick of that. And we try to find answers without going to the real root of the problem.
Kenny, you got my head spinning there, but I'm gonna try and run with that, and I appreciate your call. Paul Light, there it is again. The president comes in, he makes his appointments, and you know, Kenny says they're going to be essentially they're going to be determined by the kind of man who's elected. We elected George Bush; he's making his appointments. Okay, let's live with it.
Well, I think that we had some hopes that he would bring a stronger focus on management than perhaps he has. Here's a guy who was trained as a MBA. The focus in the curricula of the leading MBA schools, including the one that he attended, is on leadership and competence and strength and teamwork and so forth. And I think we've seen far too less of it, far too little of it than we had hoped. And I think in the future we need to really focus on this issue. And I think this silver lining in this conversation could be that we'll actually get legislation that would reduce the number of appointees and improve the quality.
David, I've just got David Johnson for half a minute here. David, you know, of course, ideology was part of what George Bush brought to Washington, but he did bring this claim also of the kind of CEO president he would be, the MBA president. And now we hear Republicans upset with issues of competence here. I know you're a Republican voice, but do you feel that unhappiness within your own party about what's going on?
we're seeing that unhappiness right now because Republicans are looking at the poll numbers and they've seen the president's numbers go down. If those numbers reverse, we're not going to see the same thing at all. And another thing that needs to be brought in mind is these same people now who are criticizing the president on both parties, a lot of them had oversight over these nominees when they were up for Senate confirmation battles, and no one opposed them at that time. And we need to look at that, too. Why, if these people were unqualified, why did no senator oppose any of these nominees?
Defend, defend. David Johnson, we hear it, and we thank you for joining us there from Strategic Vision in Atlanta, Georgia. Paul Light, Mark Thompson, please stand by. We're talking about the charge of cronyism and incompetence in the Bush administration. Listeners, what is at stake here? What's on the line? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the charge of cronyism in the Bush administration and whether it's the same as it's ever been under many administrations or something different, something worse. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined from New York by Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University, and from Washington by Mark Thompson, Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Bob is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Great subject, and very important one. Just a few points I'd like to make quickly.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
First of all, I was a Bush supporter at one time, and I'm completely turned around from that at the moment. This cronyism issue is one of the important reasons. I think that Bush's promises to institute and to put into place good management practices as a result of his fabulous education and somewhat spotty experience record in the business world is just another huge broken promise like the one he made not to get involved in nation building.
Why do you think it's happening, Bob? What's your take on it?
Because I think it's symptomatic of the problem we have with the political system in this country. And I have a comment I'd like to make about what David Johnson had to say, the fellow from Strategic Vision in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Again, his comments are symptomatic of what I think is the answer to your question. He talked about politics in this country like it involved a pack of dogs, and it's the same mentality that causes wars to be started and causes people to go cheer at football games mindlessly. I have a couple of real close-to-home examples from South Carolina I'd like to mention.
Briefly, yes, please.
Yes. One is David Wilkinson, who's the current ambassador to Canada. When he was appointed to that position, I heard him interviewed on CBC, and I know something about the man. He was asked, what do you know about Canada and how many times have you visited here? His answer was, on my honeymoon 40 years ago, and I know that it's north of Michigan.
Well, all kinds of people get made ambassador to Canada.
Okay, we know, but
to many places. What else have you got there, Bob?
Okay, the second one is even much closer to home. It involves Strom Thurmond Jr., the son of the former senator, who used to live right down the street from me. His son, Strom Thurmond Jr., was appointed by the Bush administration to be the U.S. attorney for South Carolina. This man is less than 30 years old. His previous experience was as a very junior prosecutor for the city of Aiken, which is a town of about 25,000 people. So the Bush administration picked this man out as the most qualified person to be the senior federal law enforcement agent for the state of South Carolina.
And that's
a huge embarrassment to me.
That is not meeting your sniff test, and we hear it. Mark Thompson, Paul Light, you know, there are a lot of other things that get cited here. The timber industry lobbyist as head of the Foreign Service, the mining industry lobbyist in charge of public lands, the utility lobbyist who represented some big air polluters as head of the Clean Air Division at the EPA. But Mark Thompson, the line comes back. This is what George Bush wants. He's trying to change the country, and he was elected to do it. A couple of our callers are talking now about the electoral system, but President Bush might say, look, I'm here to change, and these are the best people I could find to do it.
I mean, sure, I think the elections are a good self-correcting mechanism. And in my interviews with folks like Paul Light and others, people kept coming back to that. Listen, when you study the staffing at the top levels of the federal government, the people you're going to want have to have some knowledge about the subject they are overseeing. I've covered the Pentagon for many years, and there are many defense industry executives in this Pentagon and in all Pentagons that have come before.
Yep, yep.
But there is a difference, I think, when you get people who not only come in with the management acumen that they've acquired from having that job in the private sector, but really have ideological axes to grind. And it's true, like, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, and I'll know pornography when I see it. This is a subjective test. There's no 36-inch yardstick out there that we can measure these guys and gals against and see whether they measure up or if they come up short. You've just got to sort of feel it in your gut and get a sense of, you know, yeah, that's probably the right person for that job, or no, that's probably not the right person for that job. Go ahead.
Until the test comes, as we saw in Hurricane Katrina, and then, well, pretty much everybody agrees, we had a flunk here. I want to get one more caller. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
If I might, I'd like to reframe discussion just a slight bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that Mr. Johnson really put his finger on the right button when he invoked the name of, President Roosevelt. Because I think, from my point of view, what President Bush is up to is his agenda is to completely demolish the social welfare system that Roosevelt created. And that when you begin to look at all the things that we're talking about through that lens, all this stuff makes much, much more sense than looking at it through the lens of cronyism. And I think that, I don't know that President Bush did have a mandate to demolish the social welfare system. And I think that what Katrina has done is it said to America, do you really want to do this? This is what our country is going to look like if we demolish the social welfare system that was created, that really started with Roosevelt and was given an infusion of energy and capital by President Johnson.
And those images said it to us quite directly, and you're not sure that the mandate was quite that big. Paul Light, how about it? It raises a couple things. I mean, one is, if government doesn't matter, then maybe competence doesn't matter. Is that part and parcel of what's at work here?
Well, I think that the time piece, which is an excellent inventory of what's been going on, is on point. President Bush has sought to do through the administrative levers of government what cannot be done through the legislative branch. There is no sentiment in this country for dismantling many of the programs that the president opposes. And presidents who are forced back against that sentiment often do turn to the administrative channels. And these folks in the Bush administration, whether you like them or not, have been tightly coordinated. They have been tightly focused. A lot of Democrats I talk to say they wish the Clinton administration had been as disciplined in their use of the administrative levers as Bush has been. But there is a general conclusion to be made that you're using the administrative levers of government to do what you can't do through the ordinary legislative process. And at some point, that is a very gray area where a few presidents have dared to go. And this one has gone there in a disciplined fashion that I have never seen before, never.
Political evolution, then, or crossing some kind of danger line here, Paul?
Well, you know, there is something called the rule of law, and you can't push so far against the spirit and the actual text of law that you have undone the ability of government to discharge and faithfully execute the law. I don't think that's happened, but we've gotten very, very close here, and the ideological lockstep here among Bush appointees, many of whom are very qualified and good public servants, but also zealous, I think that we have gotten very close to that line where we are in conflict with the rule of law.
Paul Light, we're grateful to you for your insight this hour. Thank you very much for being with us.
Very welcome.
Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University, and Mark Thompson with Time Magazine, thanks to you and your whole crew for your reporting. You open our eyes, and we're grateful to you for sharing.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Thompson joined us from Washington, D.C. As we've mentioned this hour, many of the government contracts signed with companies involved in the hurricane cleanup effort have been awarded without bidding or with limited competition. Eric Lipton is a reporter for the New York Times who's been following the money on the Katrina cleanup. He joins me now from Washington. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
This term cronyism can be stretched in a lot of directions. Some people are stretching it to cover the way contracts and billions are being moved post-Katrina. You've looked into this. What do you see?
I think at this point it's too early to say for sure that there was cronyism involved here. I think it's fair to say that you can ask questions about some of the contractors that received some of the big deals because it was such a free-for-all in the first days after the storm. But it's too early to say at this point whether or not, in fact, it was favoritism.
Do you see no-bid contracts being pushed beyond what's reasonable here, or was the urgency of the crisis so great that that was necessary?
Clearly, they needed to buy a lot of things very quickly. But what they could have done, if FEMA, for example, could have had more of these arrangements where they had open competitions prior to Katrina's arrival to, for example, buy $10 million worth of portable computers that they would need to serve all the federal employees that were going to be drafted to help with this. You would have thought that they would have had an arrangement before the day that the storm arrives to have bidding among companies that could supply that, and so that they wouldn't have to just go to a dealer and buy them without any competition at all after the storm hits. So there's a lot of really large no-bid contracts, some of them worth in excess of $500 million that were awarded, which now you need to go back and look at them more closely because some of them went to companies that have quite an array of lobbyists and political connections. But what we don't know yet is whether or not they were given those contracts because of those connections or because they were just ready and able to deliver the services that were needed.
Give us a sense of some of those big no-bid contracts that have gone to politically connected firms. For what kind of work and firms with what kind of connections?
For example, Joe Albaugh, the former FEMA director and Bush, campaign manager from his first presidential race, his firm, he's now a lobbyist and government consulting guy in Washington, and his firm represents two companies that received contracts worth in excess of $100 million. One is called Shaw Group, mm-hmm. and the other is the famous Kellogg Brown and Root, the Halliburton subsidiary.
Right.
And, I mean, in his own lobby disclosure forms, he reports that he's going to be, working with Congress and the executive branch on issues like Homeland Security disaster relief issues that affect Shaw Group and Kellogg Brown and Root. So in the days after the Katrina hits, Kellogg Brown and Root gets in excess of $50 million in work, and Shaw Group has $219 million in contracts. Now, those are companies that have, that Albaugh says, very adamantly that he did not work on these contracts, and he does not, in fact, he says, help companies get contracts. He gives them long-term strategic advice. But you have that kind of correlation that now raises questions.
And pretty soon you're talking real money here. You cite a debris removal contract landed by a Florida company with ties to Mississippi's Republican governor, $568 million. We hear numbers like $200 billion or more in the pipeline for this region. Will this be brought into a kind of contract system soon, Eric? Will this be tightened up?
That process is already underway. The awarding of no-bid or limited-bid contracts has slowed significantly. I think the inspector general staff from a variety of agencies are already examining a lot of the early contracts. So there's a lot more reason that already is going to this process, but there's hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts that were awarded in the first few weeks, which are now getting a great deal of scrutiny.
Follow the money. Eric Lipton at the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
In the wake of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the Gulf Coast is still struggling to get back on its feet. But the country is clearly thinking about what those storms have more broadly revealed, something beyond flooded cities and soaring prices at the pump, something bigger about the national moment we're in right now and the crossroads the United States may be at today. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty's been thinking about that as well and joins me now. Jack, thanks for being with us. What do you see going on out there?
Well, my metaphor for it is in the book of politics, of history, the page has been lifted but not yet turned. It's clear that something is going into history here, the Bush administration. And I think that Alan Greenspan gave the key metaphor the other day. He was speaking to a French official, and he said, quote, "We have lost control of our budget in Iraq. We have lost control of events." In Katrina, Mr. Bush lost control of the reins of his government. He pulled on the FEMA rein and nothing happened. And to judge by the polls, we have lost people feel he has lost control of the economy. 60% disapprove of it. Only 8% say this financial situation is getting better. Investor optimism, 61% in August, 34% now. You know, leaders convey the sense that they're in control. Bush was strong on this a year ago. He's gone down nearly 20 points on this. So in a way, I think that the page the Bush era isn't over. He can still appoint Supreme Court justices and the like, but that page is turning.
You know, the Republicans might quote Chairman Mao, you know, revolution is not a dinner party. And maybe they'd say, well, we're part way into the way we want to remake this country and its government and its politics. And as Donald Rumsfeld said, you know, in Baghdad, it's messy.
It's messy, and change is messy, and Machiavellianly, you know, you could say that the failures of FEMA actually helped to delegitimate government, and so by the, you know, conservatives win ideologically by failing programmatically. But that's too Machiavellian for me. Sure, you can't count the conservatives out, and you certainly can't even count the president out. Harry Truman, after all, was at 21% in the polls, saddled with an unpopular war, with cronyism, and people used to say, to err is Truman. Well, they're saying that about Bush.
And then you hear noises out of the Republican camp right now, deep distress over there about the spending, about the way, from the kind of Republican Revolution vantage, President Bush has walked into this big spending, big government trap. They look just the other way, say the old-time religion's being squandered here. You wonder if there's a kind of coming apart at the seams a bit on the Republican side itself.
Events seem to have swept them in this direction of big government. It's big government often for the corporations, but you can't deny it. That's why the charge that he's trying to rip up the New Deal, I don't think, holds.
Yeah, but Jack, you say events have done it, but those bridges to nowhere in Alaska, the spending that we saw well before Katrina was awfully big.
It was awfully big, and but I think the Bush approach, Bush was never anti-government, and he believed in using government. He said that in the campaign. But what I didn't realize was that he was going to both do this on the domestic side and get into a war that's using up $5 billion a month in Iraq. Mm.
Of course, the interesting piece here is the American public itself sitting back, watching all this going on, doing its own calculations about, you know, the messages it's been hearing for the last 20 years or so about what's left, what's right, does the GOP have the right idea, do the Democrats, where that great big collective mind comes down is what ultimately matters.
Indeed, and the Democrats, you know, they're palpably hoping to return to power on a sheerly negative referendum, running against the mess in Washington. You know, just when the public might be receptive to the politics of remedy, their message seems to be it's about competence, not ideology. Yeah, they're missing in action, and their default, the idea that they can just step into power because they're against the Republicans, that's not going to work, and the public is seeing right through it.
I don't know where this leaves the next big campaign, but if I were John McCain, I'd certainly be looking on with interest here. I don't know how let's say, Hillary Clinton's view of the world intersects with this moment, but a lot in flux.
A lot in flux. A sense that this is a plastic moment, the shibboleths we've taken for granted for a long time, that, you know, poverty, that a rising economy lifts all boats. That's not happening with poverty. The market is failing in regard to the 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance. It's not doing it. We need new solutions that get by these old shibboleths.
It's a lot to keep up with, a lot to stay on top of. We're going to do our best. Jack, we always appreciate your help in doing that. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.